Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And once again, troubling events in Ferguson, Missouri. Take us to the streets.
Okay, there was just gunfire, and now cops have guns drawn.
Shots fired in the city of Ferguson early this morning, posted to YouTube, hitting two police officers less than a day after embattled police chief Thomas Jackson agreed to resign. The shooting took place amidst a protest outside the police headquarters. The two downed officers were hospitalized with injuries. They have since been released. Here's St. Louis County Police Department Chief John Belmar at a news conference today.
When this happened, when they heard the shots and when they heard the bullets singing past, they saw muzzle flashes. But these muzzle flashes were probably about 125 yards away. Fortunately, with both officers, we don't have any remarkable long-term injuries.
But this has been a clear setback for a community reacting to last week's U.S. Justice Department critical report on open racism in the Ferguson PD and the resignations of Ferguson City Manager John Shaw, Municipal Court Judge Ronald Brockmeyer, and others. Chief Belmar was careful not to blame protesters for the shooting today, but he did have strong words for the shooters.
This is really an ambush, is what it is. I mean, you know, you can't see it coming, you don't understand that it's going to happen, and you're basically defenseless from the fact that it is happening to you at the time. And that is something that is very difficult to guard against when you have a group of officers standing in a large group, and then, you know, you have gunfire, certainly gunfire directed at them.
St. Louis County Police Department Chief John Belmar. Rachel Lippman has been covering this for St. Louis Public Radio. She's found a frustrated community feeling tentative signs of recent progress eroding with this new violence.
I think you have hit it right on the head there, John. It only serves to ratchet up tensions that people were already worried were going to start rising as the weather got a little warmer. We've had a cold winter here, and it kind of put a little bit of a damper on the protests. But now that we've started to hit spring and the weather's getting warmer, you've had people saying we're going to be back out. We're going to be back out on the streets. And this certainly doesn't help people trust the protesters or trust the police officers, even though from everything that I have heard and believe, the shots were not fired by what would be called a core group of protesters.
Well, let's get to that, because I was looking at some of the details in some of the reporting from Ferguson. And is it wrong to characterize this as an apparent sniper attack from somewhere beyond the protest?
I don't know if I would call it a sniper attack. It took place up a hill from where the protesters generally gather. The police department sits along a main road. There are several smaller roads that cut off of it. This road bisects two parking lots in question, one where the protesters have been gathering. It's sort of served as sort of their base camp when they're in front of the Ferguson police station. The shots came from somewhere up on that hill. I don't know if you would characterize it as a sniper attack. But again, like I said, everything I've seen is that it did not come from the group of protesters that were gathered there.
What's been the reaction of police officers there, if you have any, so far? The deaths of two police officers here in the New York area produced really strong reactions among law enforcement in this area and led to extended unrest in the New York area and all over the East Coast.
I think we're still too early to see whether this is going to have an impact on the way that police act within the community. John Belmar, the chief of St. Louis County, did tell reporters that they may have to reevaluate how the police interact with the protesters. He said it had been remarkable that officers had not been hurt before, given the amount of gunfire they routinely took on some nights during protests.
In general, before this shooting, we would be talking about the reaction to the Department of Justice critical report on the PD there in Ferguson. Is there a sense that the police department is embattled? We've got the resignation of the police chief. What's going on right now in the department?
Chief Tom Jackson will be stepping down March 19th, and they will be conducting a national search for his replacement. Two other officers also resigned as soon as the Department of Justice report came out after they were connected to racist emails that were specifically listed in the report. It's hard to get a sense of what the officers think. And again, remember, these two officers in question who were shot last night are not Ferguson Police Department officers. One is a St. Louis County officer. One is from another municipality in St. Louis, Webster Groves, which is a kind of a southwest of Ferguson. So there were Ferguson Police Department officers on the line last night, but they were not the ones who were shot. However, they were up there, as I mentioned, with these officers, and I'm sure it's always in the back of all of their minds that they could be targets for someone just frustrated or, you know, who just generally doesn't like police officers and may not even really be connected to these protest groups.
Is there a feeling among people in Ferguson and in the St. Louis area that a cleaning of house, the, you know, changing of the guard here with all these resignations is going to begin the process of restoring trust in this community between law enforcement and citizens?
I think there's still quite a bit of skepticism as to whether or not these resignations are going to make a whole lot of difference. James Knowles, the mayor of Ferguson, remains sort of the last big fish these protesters want to see go. I think they're also upset that it took this Department of Justice report to put pressure on them. Many of them believe that as soon as Michael Brown was killed and that the stories about the Ferguson Police Department started to come out, that it should have happened then. They're very frustrated that it took the Department of Justice report to put pressure on there. And as Mayor Knowles said at his press conference yesterday, announcing Tom Jackson's resignation, the Ferguson police chief, none of the resignation statements admit wrongdoing. It's all that they believe it's best for the city and allow them to come forward. But none of them have actually come out and said, yes, we agree with the Department of Justice reports, or yes, we apologize for what went on in this community.
Great reporting. Rachel Lippman, reporter for St. Louis Public Radio. Thanks so much, Rachel.
Thank you, John.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org. Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
So is it a surprise that the Republicans in the U.S. Senate seem to be lobbying for the nation of Israel regarding Iran? Is it surprising that they're going around the White House and insisting that their votes trump the president's conduct of foreign policy and U.S. nuclear talks with Iran? Julian Zelizer is professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and author of The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. Welcome back, Julian.
Thanks for having me.
How unprecedented is this letter to Iran as you're seeing it?
I think there's more precedence than we remember. Even Lyndon Johnson faced Democrats like Senator William Fulbright, who held hearings reminding Americans what was going wrong, and Republicans who said he was too weak on defense. Speaker Jim Wright, a Democrat in 1987, got himself in some hot water when he opened up negotiation with Nicaraguan leaders without the administration's consent, although the administration was later challenged on that, over a peace plan in the region. And Reagan officials were livid. They said the speaker's conducting foreign policy on his own. And the speaker said, I'm trying to achieve some kind of a peace.
Was there talk of treason back then?
There were words like that, violating constitutional authority, circumventing the rules of government. So you did hear that.
But that's hyperbole, just like some of the talk in the letter to Iran.
Yeah, that is true. The Nixon people were often angry with Senator Henry Scoop Jackson of Washington in 1973 and 74. They wanted to pursue detente Nixon, easing relations with the Soviet, and they wanted to open economic relations with the Soviet Union. Henry Scoop Jackson was openly and publicly saying no unless the Soviets liberalized policy toward Jews. And Nixon officials spoke about this as a real violation of how diplomatic protocol should be conducted.
And that example right there almost directly mirrors what's going on here, a pro-Israel lobby within the Congress attempting to make foreign policy at odds with the White House.
And the argument then by Nixon people was that Jackson was really grandstanding, that the policy mattered, but what he really wanted was to promote himself, to promote his political agenda. Jackson said no. He said he was using the power of Congress, and that included public statements, that included challenging the president. So it was the same kind of congressional presidential clash over public policy.
Are the Republicans in the Senate helping Iran by giving them the argument that they are constantly making? I've worked in Tehran where Iranians say, hey, the U.S. government is in the pocket of the Israelis. Are the Republicans making that point?
Well, I think what Republicans are actually doing is undermining confidence in all foreign leaders that the U.S. system is capable of putting together a diplomatic agreement. You know, foreign leaders look at American politics. They understand politics doesn't stop at the water's edge. And they get uneasy when they see the U.S. system isn't capable of agreement. So certainly for some Iranians, this will play into their hands if there's no sense that the Senate will uphold this.
So treason is probably off the table. That really doesn't make a whole lot of sense here. The sense that the U.S. is a chaotic place where everyone's shouting and screaming and politically posturing, that's sort of one scenario here. But the fact that all Republicans lined up to subvert President Obama, I wonder if no one's talking about the fact that he's a black president. There's some weird racial element in this that no one's really talking about.
There could be. I mean, I don't know, and it's hard to gauge, you know, what drives this. At this point, I'll take it on face value that this is, you know, tough partisan politics lining up around foreign policy and an effort to do everything to embarrass the president, to cause problems on policy, even to appeal to evangelical Christian voters who are very much in favor of what the Republicans are doing. So I think there's many kind of politics at play, and some would argue that race is part of it. But we don't really know that at this point.
And the legacy of all this will really be what is taken into the 2016 election in some sense.
Absolutely. The next candidates are going to have to deal with the politics right now and with the actual outcome. If this subverts a treaty, I think all the candidates in both parties are going to have to deal with the instability of that region and Iran. And if a treaty's in place, Republican candidates are going to have to figure out how to uphold the treaty their own party publicly condemned.
Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, author of The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners to get legal help, including corporate filings, legal plans featuring attorney contract review, and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
Is there an extremist element to the way Congress and particularly Republican senators are working to subvert every aspect of the Obama agenda right now with a take back our country constitutional crisis tone? You can hear in these remarks from Texas Senator Ted Cruz speaking on an Iowa talk radio show.
But I'll tell you, so what I have already pledged that I will do is introduce a constitutional amendment to make absolutely clear that marriage is a question for the states. If the courts were following the Constitution, we shouldn't need a new amendment. But they are, as you put it quite rightly, making it up right now. And it's a real danger to our liberty.
Senator Ted Cruz of Texas talking to an Iowa radio host, Jan Mickelson. A new report from the Southern Poverty Law Center on radical right violence this week suggests that the tone of conservative politics in the United States right now is having an unintended consequence, making it hard for violent fringe groups to recruit and raise money. The Southern Poverty Law Center's Heidi Byrick heads up the organization's intelligence project and sees that increasingly hate groups in the U.S. are finding themselves in competition with mainstream politics. Heidi, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
This is a surprising revelation. What exactly do you mean here?
Well, I mean, what's been happening is ideas that are centered or used to be centered among radical right or extremist groups have actually found a home among mainstream politicians. As you just showed in that clip, extremist ideas about the role of the Supreme Court, the Constitution, gay rights are now being shared by people who are in Congress. And these are the same kinds of ideas that we see hate groups espousing. So in a way, the far right, or maybe even not even that far right of the Republican Party, sounds almost exactly like hate groups on issues like gay rights and immigration and others.
And that's not hyperbole to say that the Republican Party is espousing the values of hate groups?
It is absolutely not hyperbole. If you look at the anti-immigrant stance of most members of Congress, it is now indistinguishable from hate groups like the Federation for American Immigration Reform. And the hardline, actually, of anti-immigrant politics, for example, at the state level where punishing laws have been put in place in places like Alabama, they're often unconstitutional. But those ideas are literally from prominent members of the Republican Party, like Kansas Secretary of State Chris Kobach, who also, in that case, actually work for hate groups.
Now, there's an argument that can be made here that it's better to have this out in the open. It's, if it's in mainstream politics, it's not something that the intelligence group at the Southern Poverty Law Center has to, you know, seek out, you know, undercover. This is maybe a more honest approach to controversial positions.
Well, I mean, the thing, you're right, more people will be aware of it. But when it's in the mainstream, it doesn't look controversial. So things that would have been unthinkable just a few years ago have become something that people think are legitimate. You know, other places like Fox News are doing the same thing. They're literally mainstreaming positions that nobody would have taken 10 years ago. And that's scary. And it's especially scary when it's directly affecting our politics. If it's just some, you know, fringe group who is saying that, you know, immigrants should have to show their papers all the time, or gay people should not be served by businesses, that's one thing. But when our leadership is doing it, that's directly impacting those groups and the rest of society.
Now, your report this week on hate groups in the United States, it's an annual report. You note that the number of hate groups declined by 17% between 2013 and 2014. And that's a low level that hasn't been seen since 2005. Is that a parallel development here, or would you link this decline with exactly this sort of mainstream development that you're talking about?
Yeah, I think the mainstreaming has affected the organized groups. Of course, you don't need to pay monthly dues and spend a lot of time on activism if your leadership is responding to your ideas. So that's certainly part of the reason for the decline. Another part of it is just it's very easy nowadays to go on hate sites and be active with people who have the same, you know, abhorrent views you do without having to be involved in sort of real world activism. And that's the second trend that we're seeing more and more people online, both on hate sites and mainstream sites like Reddit, for example, where they're expressing views that are just disgusting, frankly, extremely racist and anti-Semitic.
And would you say that the internet enables a community of hate groups to exist, even if they aren't getting money and exchanging funds and weapons and tactics?
Without a doubt. I mean, a website like, for example, Stormfront today has 300,000 registered users. They've been adding about 25,000 registered users a year for a while now. And it's just really easy to be sort of a keyboard commando and interact there as opposed to paying dues, going to meetings. I mean, we're actually seeing this in general in society. These organized outside groups like the Kiwanis Club, the Rotary Club, and so on are declining in membership. So too hate groups as people move online to, you know, find communities that share their ideas.
Keyboard commando. Did you come up with this, or is that something that's used in the sort of world of these groups?
That is from the movement, because there are some people in the hate movement who feel that you know, real world activism should trump people who just sit at their computers, and they sometimes criticize others for being keyboard commandos.
Heidi Byrick is head of the Intelligence Project at the Southern Poverty Law Center. Thanks so much, Heidi.
Thanks for having me.
The Takeaway is supported by ShopKeep, a POS analytics and management system that works to help people grow their businesses. More information at shopkeep.com.
So how much of a national crisis would it be if the Reverend Billy Graham announced he was planning not to go to heaven after he died? Would Catholics be in turmoil if the Pope said he would prefer spending eternity in hell rather than the sedate and less interesting paradise? Well, in China, government officials are locked in a bureaucratic battle with the Dalai Lama over the Tibetan Buddhist leader's plans for his afterlife. The aging 14th Dalai Lama says he might not reincarnate after his death.
The Dalai Lama institution will cease one day. This man-made sort of institution will cease. No guarantee. Some stupid Dalai Lama comes, then disgraced himself or herself. That's very sad.
That is His Holiness speaking to the BBC in a recent interview, cheerfully suggesting that the institution of the Dalai Lama should be closed down with his passing. I'm joined by Robert Thurman, professor of Indo-Tibetan Buddhist Studies at Columbia University and an ordained Tibetan teacher. Professor, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you, John.
You can dispute those comparisons I made, but why is the Chinese government so concerned about those remarks and those sentiments from the Dalai Lama?
They're being silly, actually, you know, can't live with him and can't live without him sort of idea, where they rail against him that he's a splittist, what they call a splittist, a separatist. They pretend that they think that he wants Tibet to be separate from China. And yet, when he says that the institution of the Dalai Lama, which doesn't just mean his reincarnation, what it means is that he will reincarnate in the form of that institution, where he has automatic responsibility to govern the country. And when he says that that is, should bring to a close, he's not speculating. He has already legislated with the, in the government in exile, that he does not intend to be recognized as the ruler of the country. But his new reincarnation will be just in a monastery doing religious work, and that he will not accept political responsibility or take political office. And the Chinese, which on the one hand are annoyed with him, but on the other hand, they realize that without admitting it, that the Tibetans look to him as their leader, as their icon, as their undisputed savior, really. You know, he's like a Jesus rather than the Pope or Billy Graham. To the Tibetans, he's a living Jesus. It would be as if Jesus already had come back and comes back every year, every time at the end of every life. And then he actually tells the sheriff what to do and tells the Congress what to do. That's what, how the Tibetans look at the Dalai Lama. But he's saying the Tibetans should have in the future a democracy, and they should have local elections, and sort of like Hong Kong, one country, two systems within China, but actually real democracy within China, not just appointed by the Chinese.
Well, what about the Tibetans? What about the Tibetans? Are they spiritually in crisis over the Dalai Lama making this decision, or is it just fine?
No, no, they're not really in crisis about it. They might be in the future. When the Dalai Lama passes, they accept whatever he says, and so he says he's not going to be telling them what to do, and they have to figure it out for themselves, so they're working on that in exile. In the future, the new young Dalai Lama, at some point, the one who's officially recognized by spiritual leaders in Tibet, in exile, they will respect that person as the Dalai Lama. And should there come the opportunity, they might try to volunteer him to again accept some sort of mediating role, or at least symbolic role as leader of the country. But he's already legislated against that, and he's made clear statements against it, and he hopes they won't do that. That thing that he said, that maybe the next one would be a stupid Dalai Lama, and therefore it would disgrace the institution. And now I'm a popular Dalai Lama, so this is a good time to give up power.
Well, we certainly don't need a stupid Dalai Lama here in the 21st century with all the troubles that we have. Yeah,
that's right, especially because nowadays he's kind of like a Dalai Lama to the world.
Robert Tenzin Thurman is professor of Indo-Tibetan Buddhist Studies at Columbia University and an ordained Tibetan teacher. Thanks so much, Professor.
My pleasure, John.
When writer Luis Alberto Urrea's best-selling book, The Devil's Highway, was published in 2005, it provided a searing glimpse into the reality of U.S. border policy by telling the true story of what happened to a group of Mexican men trying to cross into Arizona. A decade later, in a new collection of poems, Urrea writes of the border world around the city of Tijuana with the same lyrical energy of a 21st century Walt Whitman. The Tijuana Book of the Dead is a violent, passionate testimony to Urrea's roots and the realities of a war zone most Americans know almost nothing about.
It's my first book of poetry in well over 10 years, and I had worked on this manuscript on and off and on and off, and then, you know, it was really the catalyst was watching all the book bannings in Arizona and watching these children, brown children, have their books taken away. And it wasn't just Latino writers. They took indigenous writers away. They took Sherman Alexie away from them. They took Sandra Cisneros away from them. And then in the ultimate weirdness, Arizona pulled Shakespeare out of brown hands because they felt that the Tempest was going to inspire, I think, anti-American, anti-colonialist feelings. I don't know what they were thinking. And I saw children going to jail for protesting to keep their poetry. And I thought, is this America, really? I guess I can say I'm blessed to speak to lots and lots and lots of kids because I've seen how hurt they are, how heartbroken they are, and how sort of head-hangingly embarrassed they are by the relentless media campaign and, you know, the happy radio talkers, not you, but you know who I mean, who assault them constantly. And I just came out of a place. If it's possible to feel rage in love, that's what finally happened. And it overtook all the other poetry I was trying to put together.
Well,
you, as a poet, you find beauty in things that you wouldn't think are beautiful. I mean, here's a pure bit of art, it seems to me, even though there's some anger in here as well. Insomnia Machine, and I can smell the back alley where that generator is going, or whatever kind of machine you were thinking. What is that engine coiled in cables and red hoses that lurches at the darkest hour as it pumps, pumps, churns, desires and nightmares out the main line, sends hot want into the alley, down the hall, in the window as it rusts itself, keeps us awake all night, all night, all night, like a motel neon sign in the rain, pounds to death that working machine that makes us weep, that imagines God, that drives the pistons that slug in hollow graveyard shifts, that dynamo that suddenly snaps and wrenches itself apart as we shout, human beings once called it a heart.
Jeez. I loved hearing that. You know, there are some themes in this book. It's kind of part of my obsession, I think, to write for and to the forgotten. I always have, which sometimes seems like, you know, commercial suicide. I had this complete obsession with writing a literature of witness, and it's still there. And I always believed if you represented people nobody cares about, that that was an important thing to do and everybody would care. And for a very long time, of course, nobody cared. But then people start to care, and it's really moving to me. So that poem specifically, it also is related to the poem Lines for Neruda, which begins, "We were the men who worked the machines." So I very much in the process of all this had in mind my father, who came across the border from Mexico. He went from deep Mexico to Tijuana, which is a shocking transition anyway, and then from Tijuana to the United States, and could not find his footing. And he, you know, went from a pretty accomplished life in Mexico to being a janitor and a bowling alley attendant for my entire life. So I would spend many hours with him in the backs of bowling alleys watching his, you know, blue collar to no collar kind of work and learning all those physical skills, which would be of no use to me in my life. How do you repair a bowling pin? You know, he'd mount it on a lathe and he would, you know, hit it with all this weird smelling kind of pipe dope to fill up the holes and put fiberglass on it and shellac. But it was this beautiful work of art that my father did invisibly in the back of this dark, clanging, noisy, malodorous place full of old nudist magazines and these broken doors that were chained together with chains and padlocks where junkies and prostitutes would push it and look in at him. I thought, wow, you know, that's really intense, and it's lost, and it's forgotten, and it's abandoned partially in shame.
Well, let me push you here then. I mean, you write for the forgotten. You write as a literature of witness, and that is certainly great, and you read it and feel it in these words. But, you know, Senator Ted Cruz of Texas tells the same kind of story about his dad coming from mm-hmm. Cuba. And, you know, it's got some of the same details that you just mentioned right there. Isn't it important for Ted Cruz and people like him to see themselves in your poetry, for this literature to have the power it needs to have if you want to change things?
Yeah, absolutely. I do think so. I think that, you know, some of the divisiveness that's present in our country is healthy, and a lot of it is unhealthy. And I think that, you know, Rudolfo Anaya, our great Chicano novelist, told me something when I was just a kid, and I've taken it to heart. And he said, you know, if you can make your grandmother in Tijuana the grandmother of a reader as far away as Iowa, then you have committed the most powerful political and religious act that one can commit. And so, you know, you want to hold up a mirror. Sometimes it's, you know, maybe a slideshow of somebody else's life, but there has to be something there that makes us pause and say, by God, we're the same. We are people. It's us. It's not a literature or a world of all these them people who are coming in to steal from me. It's a place where we are trying to make the best of it. So yeah, you know, I don't know if he would like my work or not. Perhaps he would see me as you know, there's no pan-Hispanic movement. And so although the marketing wants to think that, the Chicanos and Dominicans and Puerto Ricans and Cubans and, you know, Latin Americans and Central, we're all the same. It's not. There are different views, different accents, different flourishes. But I think the basic humanity, the goodness of a working person doing what he or she has to do to keep the family going is universal. And it's always important to me to try to create the best art I can in honor of people that I love.
Luis Alberto Urrea is author most recently of the Tijuana Book of the Dead. His book of short stories, The Water Museum, comes out next month. Luis, thanks so much.
Thank you. It was great talking to you.
And here's something to take with you today. Winston Churchill transformed the 20th century battlefield by helping to invent the armored tank back in 1916. How much blood do you think was shed in tank warfare? Well, a vial of Churchill's blood is scheduled to be auctioned today. The market value, quote, is a very difficult thing to estimate, an expert appraiser said. Very difficult. Oh, my goodness. Very difficult to estimate. Every day, The Takeaway involves listeners in the next day's program. You can start the conversation via text message. Get your voice heard. Text the word START to 69866. Standard message rates apply, all that. You can always call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to respond to anything you heard this hour. And you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Jay Hockenberry, or check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.